Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 771, September the 15th, 1986. For those of you who want bibliographies of these broadcasts, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to me in care of P.O. Box 22511, Carmel, California, 93922. If you send an envelope once a month and put which month you want the sheets for, you can collect the sources of information that I use on the air. Wall Street Journal had a large editorial this past week, September the 9th, War in the Shadows, and it cites our confrontations with the Soviet Union, with terrorism, spying, drug running, hostage taking, and comes out and says that war is in the shadows. And all of these strategies of tension have been built up for the purpose of escalating what the Defense Department and the CIA wanted since 1943, which was World War III. And the buildup of those events is just about pouring over now until we will be ready to stage this war that they are so anxious for. The newspaper, the front page of the San Francisco Examiner and the Los Angeles Herald this past week, September the 11th, 1986, had these titles. On the top of the page, it said, State of Siege. Pinochet sends tanks after assassins. Then there were another, was another large column, State of Terror. And below there were three columns. One, Pakistani detectives lay out dragnet for hijack accomplices. So that's from the New York Times. Two, Sharon eat words, linking quotes. That's a statement attacking Prime Minister Perez regarding the synagogue bombing in Turkey. And then three, Paris, Cologne, and Holland, all targets of terrorist bombs. And then below it says, Fullerton man's death at the hands of Karachi hijackers. And it tells about one of the people who was killed, Mr. Surendra Patel, and how he was the victim of one of the people killed. There were several from Los Angeles who were killed. And he had been on a trip to India, and he was one of those unfortunate ones that didn't survive the terrorism in Turkey. I'm going to try to reduce a lot of the things that you have seen and heard the past week and a half in the news as quickly as I can, because to take every article would be laborious for you, but I've outlined them, and I've come to certain conclusions about what is going on, and I want to summarize these for you. On August the 31st, the headlines were about Mr. Danilov from U.S. News and World Report being arrested by the KGB, and prior to that, August the 22nd, was the gas that exploded. There was a loud explosion, poisonous gas that killed over 1,700 people in Cameroon, although the world didn't know about it until August the 26th, and was 5 days later the arrest of Danilov. Then August, following the Danilov arrest, August 31st, September the 6th, was the Pakistan hijacking of airplane that had come from India to Pakistan. And September the 7th was the shootout at the synagogue in Turkey, where a large number of Jews were praying and were gunned down. And September the 7th was the evening that Ronald Reagan got off of his eagle's nest perch, where he'd been sitting for 3 weeks while all this violence was cooking up, and went down to Los Angeles to kick off the senatorial campaign for Ed Chau. The allies who assisted us in these agent provocateur activities, they were our allies, Mr. Zia, Pakistan, and the NATO officers at Turkey, or the Defense Department with the Cameroon experiments, or the CIA and the Soviet Union. These were factors that worked for this control, the world order control, eventually to have a world war where they can wipe up the people who were in their way, the leftists, the liberals, and make that attack on the Soviet Union. The victims, of course, were always the third world kinds of people, people from India, on that particular plane, Jews in Turkey, blacks in Cameroon, and the Democratic members of the Senate. Now, that's a simplistic reduction of a cause and effect, but Hitler came to power through the Freikorps, through violence, through lying about the Reichstag fire, for lying on the causes to Poland. The whole series of election processes that made it possible for Adolf Hitler involved assassinations and lies and covert actions. And we have to look at those parallels or ask some questions about these events. Now, the arrest in the Soviet Union not only was of a reporter, but it was a total media event and will be until we're just tired of hearing about it. As I say, August the 31st is when Mr. Daniloff, Nicholas Daniloff, reporter for the U.S. News and World Report, was arrested. San Francisco Examiner, this is September the 9th, had an article, USSR says Daniloff was a CIA go-between between a Murat Nadarbog. He was a CIA chief in Moscow, and he was U.S. counselor for regional affairs in the embassy. He left Moscow last summer, and later they also named another CIA agent person that he was working with in Russia. Foreign Minister Gennady Gerasimov, I don't know if I pronounced it properly, described CIA schemes where he collected information of military nature, participated at instruction of CIA spy activities to establish clandestine relations with a Soviet citizen with a view to transmit information to the United States. Now, Daniloff was there under U.S. News and World Report. Lee Harvey Oswald went as a defector from the United States and worked at Minsk Radio Factory. But interestingly enough, as soon as he got home from the Soviet Union and was at Fort Worth, Texas, he hired a Mrs. Bates as a secretary, and she testified that she typed up notes and installations about airplane sightings and railroads and military installations in the Soviet Union. So he was able to procure a secretary and was observing information of a military nature. So if Oswald as a defector could be doing that, there's no reason that Mr. Daniloff couldn't be doing the same thing. The interesting part about Daniloff, and there were so many articles this week, the most interesting to me was Mrs. Daniloff's diary, the story she wrote. It was published in the U.S. News Report. It was reprinted in the Chronicle, the San Jose Mercury. And I just want to give you a bit of her account because it tells you so much about the whole affair. She said, Nick left at 11 o'clock in the morning to meet Misha, a friend, incidentally, we've never heard from since. I don't know if the Soviet Union arrested him. If these were two spies working together, why arrest one? We've never heard where Misha is. He goes to meet Misha, who lives in another town. He knew him 5 years ago, saw him a year ago. And the excuse for seeing Misha, she said, was that he was thirsting for United States knowledge and wanted modern American literature. So Nicholas wrapped up paperbacks by Stephen King. Well, you know there's something wrong right there. If you call Stephen King American literature that he's thirsting for, there must be microdotting or something. Stephen King's books are just filled with violence, and for my sake, I don't call them American literature, not worth risking your reputation about. At 5 o'clock, Philip Taubman, T-A-U-B-A-M-A-N, from the New York Times, went to Mrs. Daniloff's house and said, did you know an American correspondent was arrested? So she didn't know, but a New York Times reporter told her. So the New York Times knew first and told Mrs. Daniloff. She hadn't been called by her husband or the embassy. The question is, why would the New York Times be the first one on the spot to know about a reporter being arrested? The KGB aren't that open with American reporters, I don't presume. At 5:30, 30 minutes later, Ruth Daniloff went to the office of U.S. News and World Report, where her husband worked, and he was on the telephone talking to them. And so the New York Times knew, and Daniloff called his newspaper. Then she refers to Jeff Trimble from the U.S. News Report, calling the American Embassy in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union hadn't heard anything about Daniloff's arrest. So the U.S. News and Daniloff and New York Times, this triad and Mrs. Daniloff, had assembled a news media operation that would go to the jail and make a scene, and the American Embassy suggested that they don't do this. It might put pressure on them, and she said she didn't care at all about what the Soviet Union thought, that she would go and bring the press. So she got through a telephone grapevine a whole lot of people to go there, and then she said, thank God Nick had the presence of mind to call the office first, that's the U.S. News, and not the embassy. Well, I would think that if he were suspected of being a spy, that the Soviet Union would call the American embassy first. This is a business between two countries, but they let him call his newspaper because she said already then the press corps was dialing the number Nick gave me and the number of the KGB, and they started a phone barrage and press conferences. And at this point, she didn't care what the American embassy said. The world must know what's going on. Nicholas must know that, and his Soviet colleagues must know that the world press are behind him, and the message and foreign policy is conducted in the press. Well, so much for that. It took off like wildfire, and the press has been carrying it ever since. Now, last two weeks, I've been doing an opinion based upon government experiments on Cameroon, And then I believe that was a neutron bomb tested down there, or a chemical weapon that killed over 1,700 people. I'm not going to do much on that. That event was simply clouded by the other news, although 1,700 in this case died, which is worse than the synagogue or the hijacking. It happened simultaneously with the visit of Prime Minister Shimon Peres from Israel. I just want to give you two articles that came out this week, and then I'll fill in the Cameroon material next week. One was the San Francisco Examiner. This was on September the 14th. It's Cameroon has a mystery. The gas is a mystery. The international investigation team looking into the cause of a huge cloud of gas that rose out of the volcanic lake have found no answer to the mystery. The cloud, it was the cloud that killed over 1,500, it was about 1,700, prompted many theories on what happened. We cannot identify any other causes than a single cause, which is a combination of causes to explain the occurrence. And then September 13th, New York Times said, gas victims may have died quickly, within seconds. Scientists have tentatively concluded carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide caused the death in Cameroon. A second AID team was sent to find the cause of the blast. They've been unsuccessful. No evidence of volcanic activity. Earthquake, we don't really know. Explosions preceded toxic clouds, and there were chemical burns on people. As I say, I'll do a lot more on that. I want to get on to the terrorism and the elections and the participation of Ronald Reagan and what all of this other violence means. Not that this isn't important. Cameroon is a very big, important, probably the most important of all the other stories, but it is being buried by a lot of the other news. Jack Anderson had a small section of his column September the 2nd, referring to Africa, the home of the plague, pestilence, drought, famine, locusts, and now toxic gases, and he refers to starvation in Sudan and other horrors. Now, the Pakistan hijacking was the next event. There was the Cameroon, and then the Danilov arrest, and then the Pakistan hijacking, which took place September the 6th. Mr. Zia of Pakistan is a close ally of Ronald Reagan. He needs money. He is cracking down on his opposition members. And Mrs. Bhutto, he released her from prison, but he's cracking down. He's getting more despotic and desperate than ever, and he's identical to Mr. Pinochet of Chile, another one of our allies, who are no more nice guys, who have never been, but are going to get meaner as the activities escalate towards this big confrontation that all of them were really hoping for, to wipe out the people they really don't like. And that's where the poisons from Cameroon will be very useful in their hands, and it is in their hands. Now, the enemy of Zia, of course, is India, and the plane for the hijacking emanated in India. I just want to cite the titles of about 7-8 articles regarding the hijacking with not too much comment, and I think you'll get a picture of what I'm seeing. September the 6th, the LA Herald, Huntington Beach resident Rajesh Kumar, K-U-M-A-R, was singled out. He's been a United States citizen just since July the 11th, and he had gone to India to pick up his aunt and grandmother. But the headlines and under it go into the fact that he was singled out. Houston Post, September the 7th, hijacking puts India at odds, and it tells about the conflicts they've had before, and the hijacking makes it worse. September the 8th, this is San Francisco Examiner. Grandmother of Kumar came from India. She was returning with him to California, and the family didn't know where she was. She was missing, and they didn't know in the hijacking what happened to her. Then the California family found out that not only had he been singled out, the first person called and gunned down, but that his grandmother had been murdered and cremated, and the family hadn't even been notified that she was dead. This is in the hands of Pakistan, our close ally. September the 9th, the People's World. Pakistan tied to Indira Gandhi murder that took place October 31st, 1984. This is an article of the role of Zia in Pakistan. Zia put in power, of course, by Henry Kissinger, and the Sikhs were the first suspects because shooting into the temple there, this would be vengeance for Mrs. Gandhi for shooting into their temple in India. But arming the temple with drugs and money came from Pakistan and the CIA and Mr. Zia. So an article just came out last week of the links, or 2 weeks ago, to Mrs. Gandhi's murder to Pakistan. July 7th, 13th, this is preceding by several months, before Ronald Reagan took his vacation, Pakistani leader meeting with President Ronald Reagan. He met with him in July, this middle of July. The big topics of discussion were Afghanistan, where the CIA is throwing in millions of dollars, and drug trafficking. Reagan is starting a $2 or $3 billion attack against drugs, and Mr. Zia is one of the largest suppliers of drugs into the United States. People's World had an article September the 6th, 1986, titled, All Four Terrorists at the Pakistan Airport, Led by Hijacked Leader Gomer Hussein, H-U-S-S-E-I-N. And the article goes on that Hussein was registered at the Perugia University in Genoa in 1984. Perugia University for Foreigners is the crossroads of fascist terrorism. Fascist Mehmet Ali Agha, the man who shot at Pope John Paul II, was enrolled May 13, 1981, just prior to his attack on Pope John Paul II. It is a center for CIA, Italian secret police, right-wing business circles. And the article goes on, weapons for the hijackers, acquired by Pakistan, had been used previously to hijack Indian airlines in the past. They came from a West German firm delivered to Pakistani police and the intelligence. The Karachi hijackers used Pakistani air security uniforms and insignia to get aboard the plane, the Pan Am airliners, suggesting a lot of collusion, and I believe there was for very good reasons, but I'm just citing this article. The Houston Post, September the 6th. Pan Am claims the airport is to blame for the security lapse. 10 days earlier, they received a warning that this was going to happen, that they got word that there would be clever impersonation of security guards by gangs of hijackers, and the security was, of course, was not there to stop the hijackers. In Greece, when they were involved with hijacking, or they used the Greek airport to have a hijacking, we called off traveling to Greece, reprimanding them, not landing United States airplanes there. None of this with Turkey. They did us a favor by creating the situation so that the people in charge were not going to stop, and they had warning of it. Another article, September the 7th, from the Houston Post, commandos delayed 15 minutes after the firing started. They waited that long. And the San Jose Mercury, September the 10th, officials' confusion led to the rescue. They knew the generator was going to give out, the batteries of the generator, when it was dark. That's when the shooting started. There was no more fuel for the cabin lights. It was running out, and a team of seven senior Pakistani officials, high up in the government and police, said that they didn't know who was in charge, so they made no decision on having more fuel put in, and after the darkness came is when the shootout started and all the terror took place. That was in Pakistan. Now, the fourth major event in this series is in Turkey, where the synagogue was attacked, and that was attacked September the 7th, one day after the Pakistan hijacking, where people from India were singled out and murdered, specifically identified and wanted, and then shooting at random in the dark. Newsweek, September 16th, has the title, Slaughter in the Synagogue, 19 Jews Gunned Down. Now, we have very close ties to the government of Turkey. The National Security Council has Robert Keith Gray of the public relations firm, the Powerhouse. Incidentally, Gray just sold his firm to another company and merged with Karl Boyer, B-Y-O-R. And in my article on the links of the Nazis to the John Kennedy murder, I write about Boyer and the Howard Hughes Organization and also J. Peter Grace and the connections to Nazi Germany, of Hughes to Nazi Germany, so that Robert Keith Gray's offices have just merged. Gray is very close to William Casey and Paul Laxalt and Ronald Reagan. And our other close ties to Turkey with the CIA are Paul Hensey, the CIA station chief in Turkey, who works closely with Alexander Haig, and Francesco Pazienza from the Italian Secret Service, close to Ronald Reagan, and Licio Gelli, who was at Reagan's inauguration, the man who masterminded the P2, the Masonic Lodge, the reemergence of the Gestapo. He was in the Waffen-SS. Gelli is in South America now. But Claire Sterling and Michael Ledeen of the National Security Council, Paul Hensa, and the whole gang are very close to the Turkish government. In fact, the day that the plane was hijacked in Turkey, Michael Ledeen was on television for about an hour giving an interview about it. But these people worked with Frank Turpel, Robert Keith Gray's office worked under Henry Kissinger and with George Bush, CIA director also, with Task Force 157, with Frank Turple, who trained and bragged about training Aja. So there's no coincidence that the shootout that took place when Pope John Paul II was killed shouldn't have to link to the same places or the gun locations or the training center of people involved in the Pakistan hijacking. And then the synagogue, the Turkish connections to the CIA and NATO are just overwhelming. Now, September the 7th, 1986, September the 7th, 1972 was the Olympic Games massacre. And that's when Jewish athletes were killed in Munich, Germany. It was the first Olympics since Hitler's being in power since 1936, the Olympics there. And there were strong links to the CIA, to George Habash, to our intelligence community, and to the PLO involved in killing Jews at the time of the Olympic Games. Now, one article I want to cite from the San Francisco Examiner regarding the synagogue is titled, "Confusion Over Report on Synagogue, Witnesses Dispute Report." Istanbul, Turkey government is trying to identify two gunmen who sprayed with their machine guns through hand grenades at worshippers. The gasoline poured on victims, and then they were set ablaze. Interior Minister Yildirim Akdulut said the attack carried out was by two unidentified gunmen who were killed in the synagogue when the grenades went off, and he wanted to identify them. Members of the synagogue said, survivors said, that there were four terrorists and not two. One person whose father was killed, Gabriel Saul, said that four, not two, as the government wanted to pass it off. One of them was 22 or 23 years old. I saw one of them running away from the synagogue after the attack, and a gentleman gal is seen in a shop opposite the synagogue said two men ran away on foot. Now, this article says that the Turkish journalists now believe the government's version of the massacre was a ploy to put off any guard or any gunman who fled by not confirming that they are searching for them. But here's a punchline that is very important to all this. Two Polish submachine guns were in the attack, and they determined the grenades were made by the Soviet Union. Now, Samuel Cummings, who has the largest supply organization of weapons of all sorts, buys Russian weapons and also Polish from all over the world, and he's the arms merchant whose locations are in Virginia and in London. He's the brother-in-law of Senator John Tower, who was instrumental in bringing Marina Oswald to Texas and passing up all obstacles to her getting there by June 1962. He's a supplier of weapons, but it's very important in these headlines to identify the weapons with, just as the shooting of the Pope, the Bulgarian connections, the KGB, to say these are Polish because Poland is an Iron Curtain country, and that the grenades were made by the Soviet Union to bring in the Soviet Union. Now, on top of all of that violence, we have, as I say, the Danilov event, the affair carried in the newspapers. And the aftermath of all of this was similar or identical to when President Eisenhower wanted to meet with Nikita Khrushchev, and that meeting was called off in 1960 because of the Pentagon's decision to fly the U-2 flight and break up d'entente or any chance of peace talks. And these events, of course, are the same wedge, the identical way they're happening. It's almost like rereading history. It's a deja vu. September the 10th, Wall Street Journal, superpower clash over a jailed reporter is bolstering the United States, U.S., and the Soviet hardliners. The Monterey Herald, September the 10th, the arrest of Danilov shifts the tone of the summit meeting. Los Angeles Herald, September the 11th, the Soviets and the United States raise the stakes in the Danilov affair. And this goes into the conflicts and the confrontations. And whatever paper you take in whatever city you hear this, you're seeing it all in your newspapers, the tone of the summit, and so forth. Now, the next subject along these lines to follow this terrorism is the campaign of Ronald Reagan. Now, Reagan has problems. We could spend the next year till the end of the year on the various lawsuits, cases, scandals, dirty business dealings that his people are involved with. And he is desperate to get the Senate, of course, the GOP Senate, filled with his own kind to make the judge appointments that he wants. And one of the things that people are not aware of that is very important is he will select the next director of the FBI. Before he retires, He has the selection, Mr. William Webster's time is up, and Ronald Reagan will make it. So there's a battlefield now for Reagan to get the courts filled, get the levels of the judges filled, the appeals courts, and the appointments, and not be stampeded or be asked questions by Democratic members of the House or Senate. The Senate is the important matter. Washington Times, which is Reverend Moon's paper, September the 5th, written by Jeremiah O'Leary, and this is while Reagan's up at the Eagle's Nest, Reagan ready to launch a two-month campaign blitz. This is like Hitler's blitzkrieg. Another article, September the 3rd, Jack Anderson. Senate elections worry the White House. A bad case of political jitters. If they lose the Senate, there are grave implications for Reagan's programs. Another article, Houston Post, September the 7th. President opening drive to retain Senate control. Losing Senate would inflict Reagan with lame duckism. Will be more than lame duckism. There's the Raymond Donovan case, a Paul Laxalt case with links to the mafia in Las Vegas. There's the Jackie Presser Teamsters story, about 100 other investigations, and we've gone into a lot of them on this broadcast. San Francisco Examiner, September 14th, John Jacobs article. No doubt about it, Senate is the battleground. If Democrats control the Senate, it would be simply impossible for Reagan to appoint his cronies. And Newsweek, September 15th, Senate toss-up. Fall schedule reads like a Baedeker to the battleground of states. This is literally a war or preceding a war, depending how far Reagan can go. Now, the date of the synagogue massacre took place September the 7th. And then Ronald Reagan, that was on a Saturday. And Sunday, Reagan leaves the Eagle's Nest in Santa Barbara. And he goes to Los Angeles to the Century City Hotel, where there's a $1.5 million dinner raised for Representative Ed Schau of California, who's running against Alan Cranston. Reagan said, if we win this California Senate race, we will keep control of the United States Senate. Cranston versus Schau. So there was this large dinner party at Century City. It was the day after the massacre where the Jews were killed in Turkey, where alleged Soviet grenades were used and Polish weapons. And at the dinner was a rabbi, Yale Butler, who writes for one of the Jewish newspapers in Los Angeles. Reagan has never had these big banquets with Jews, rabbis, at his dinners. He's been very arm's distance from them and stayed away from them. But this is a campaign to get the Jewish vote against Cranston. So in comes Butler to give the invocation there so he's visible with Ed Schau. And preceding it, as I say, preceding the dinner, September the 5th, the Pakistan, the hijacking, September the 6th, the synagogue shooting, September the 7th, Sunday night, is the large dinner that opens up the Schau event. And the San Francisco Examiner had a story, September the 9th, 1986, the following day, Schau begins using terrorism as an issue against Cranston. This is in Santa Clara, where a dinner was given, a banquet where they raised $500,000 the next evening, and the chairman of the dinner was David Packard. The finance chairman for Ed Schau is David Packard, former Secretary of Defense. Now, this is the way the story is. Representative Schau had a lagging campaign against Senator Cranston until he finally stumbled upon a timely issue, terrorism. A $800,000 two-week TV campaign is underway where he will say that Democrat Alan Cranston opposed anti-terrorist bills. The ad was planned to alternate scenes of Schau in a sweatshirt relaxed at Stanford campus at his alma mater. But with the sudden terrorist eruptions in Pakistan and Turkey, Schau team abruptly dropped the Stanford scene and planned to do terrorist spots instead. We were incredibly lucky with the timing, said a Schau campaign staffer. The Schau attack comes after he had been receiving in of some nasty ads of Cranston. At a dinner where 900 people paid $500 each, with former Secretary of Defense David Packard putting on the dinner, Packard, an old Stanford classmate of Schau, Schau began his speech and he said he will attack Cranston for bringing his idea of bringing terrorists to justice, that he's not for shooting them on the spot. He defined that, he said, while Schau favored the Reagan administration policies, he defined as including bringing terrorists to justice and preemption, Cranston was voting against getting tougher abroad. He spoke to his favorite audience of engineers, electronics industry, and so forth in the Silicon Valley. And he said, by luck, he has a campaign issue. It will be terrorism. and just magnify that throughout the United States, where every Senate seat is. With the Jewish vote, the sympathy, get tough on the terrorists. The Jews have been gunned down in the synagogue. They're hijacking planes. And keep in mind that our two allies, Turkey and Pakistan, it was in their states where the terrorism took place. And the benefit of all that will be the Senate races and Ronald Reagan to assure that he can keep supplying those NATO terrorists with the arms that they need. I'll take a one-minute break and then go on to some very important matters. But that is a summary of this past week's events, if you can summarize it in 30 minutes.